أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين. One of the important issues that our day-to-day lives involves, which is a very important one, one that has come into the spotlight and is questioned, especially by the new generation, the younger generation, the youth, from multiple dimensions and different aspects of this concept, is the issue of taqleed. The first simple question, which I think a lot of people are over this particular question, but it's, I think, important for us to very briefly brush over it and remind those who already know, and maybe for those who haven't heard the explanation, give an explanation which we come to a full understanding of why this concept of taqleed is there. Then there's a couple of other more in-depth and fundamental questions that arise in regards to the concept of taqleed, which we hope that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us to be able to understand for our good brothers and sisters, inshallah. There's one misunderstanding in regards to taqleed, and that is that people say taqleed is wajib. I have not seen in any risala where it says taqleed is wajib. And the scholars that say taqleed is wajib, they mean it in a certain way, and I'll explain. Taqleed in itself is not wajib at all. It's not a must. No, not at all. In fact, Islam doesn't even encourage us to do taqleed. What does Islam encourage us to do? Something else which we'll get to. What we have as a responsibility, what is wajib, is that we need to practice. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran says, وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسِ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. We need to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We need to serve Him. We need to do what He has told us. We need to stay away from things that He has forbidden us from. Now, living 1400 years after the Holy Prophet, living 1000 years after the Imams, during the time of the occultation, how are we going to come and learn about what are the things that are wajib, what are the things that are forbidden? How do we learn that? We don't have the Holy Prophet around us. We don't have the Holy Prophet to access him, to ask him the questions. Although the Imam of our time is a living Imam and he is around, but unfortunately we're not privileged to be able to speak to him in a way that we would at the time of the Prophet and at the time of the other Imams, alayhim jami'an salawatullah. We don't have that luxury. We can't ask him our questions. And we hope that a time comes, a day comes, that our beloved Imam returns and we have prepared ourselves for that time where we can ask him the questions directly. So during this time, how are we going to make sure we are fulfilling our responsibility to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The first option that Islam actually encourages us is to go and learn for ourselves. The process of learning for ourselves is the process of ijtihad. In other words, sometimes people think that, okay, you know, we don't want to listen to these ulama, we don't want to listen to these maraja, we don't want to listen to people with these big amamas on their heads, we don't like to listen to people sitting in Qumran Najaf, they have nothing to do with what we have to do over here, they don't understand that, this, that, the other, and so on and so forth, which many of us have heard. Well, let's just say, let's put the disrespect aside for a second here, and say, all right, you want to study on your own, great, that's not only fine, it's encouraged, go ahead and do that. But we need to make sure we are fulfilling our responsibility to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Going and looking through the sources and coming up with the conclusion, what is wajib, what is haram, what our responsibility to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is, this is not an easy task. You think it's easy. The more you become familiar with it, the more you realize this is not something that people can just spend their time on. It's not as simple as picking up a book and understanding what the Arabic language is, or if I already know Arabic, then I can pick up Wasa'il al-Shia, or I can pick up Al-Kafi and say, oh, this is what Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi said. That is looking at it too simplistically. For example, how do you even know that this book that is called Al-Kafi, and you've heard a lot of good things about it, What is your proof that these are actually the words of the Ahlul Bayt? What is the proof? Have you seen them? Have you heard the Ahlul Bayt say that? When you look at the work of the ulama who've studied this book and other books, I'll just give you one small example. There's a hadith that Shaykh At-Tusi, another of the great contributors to our collections of hadith, who has compiled two books, At-Tahdhib and Al-Istibsar, which are referred to as At-Tahdhibain together, these two very important books that we have. What he tries to do on top of just mentioning the hadith is he gives a very brief analysis of whether this hadith is acceptable or it is not acceptable, or when you look at this hadith compared to a different hadith, which kind of, it seems like at least at first glance that they're contradicting, how do we put these two together in light of one another? How do we interpret them? He tries to give that bit of insight as well, but very briefly again, and that's a whole story of why he's done that. I don't want to get into that. Nevertheless, what I want to refer to is that sometimes when he narrates a hadith, that he narrates through the author or the compiler of the book Al-Kafi. The author of Al-Kafi is Shaykh Al-Kulayni. He says that this hadith is narrated by Shaykh Al-Kulayni. Now, when he wants to analyze it, and especially when there is another hadith that suggests a different solution, a different practical solution than the one that he narrates from Shaykh Al-Kulayni or through Shaykh Al-Kulayni, he says the first problem with this hadith that Shaykh Al-Kulayni narrates is that he's the only one that narrates this. In other words, here we are sitting almost 1,000 years after Shaykh Al-Kulayni has compiled Al-Kafi, and we may think that everything that's there is from the Ma'sumin, but the scholar who is a very well-known scholar, a very honest, a very sincere, a very pious scholar that lived less than a century or around a century after Shaykh Al-Kulayni did, when he looks at the hadith that Shaykh Kulayni narrates, he says, well, if it's only Shaykh Kulayni narrating, that's not something that is positive. We have to look and see why other ulama have not narrated this. So if the ulama of that era are looking at hadith in that way, then 14 or 1,000 years approximately after that, then we've got to be a little more selective and a little more careful of which hadith we are going to accept, for what reason, and so on and so forth. In terms of interpreting the ahadith, where you have what would be referred to as contradictions, or in the usuli term, ta'arud, how do you reconcile between these ahadith? How do you interpret them? Which one are you going to accept and which one are you going to reject? Are you going to be able to combine them all the time? What if you can't? And so on and so forth. There's a procedure that needs to be taken. We need to figure out what we're going to do there. And there's plenty of examples. It shouldn't be taken as, one should not think that there are very limited examples of this. And other ideas that need to be thought of. For example, how the ahadith are going to be understood in light of the Holy Quran. If the Holy Quran says طعام البحر حل لكم or أحل لكم طعام البحر, we have made the food of the sea halal on you, then we have a hadith that says anything except for fish that have scales on them is not allowed to be eaten. How are we going to treat those ahadith? Are we going to say that that goes against the verses of the Holy Quran? Are we going to say that no, that actually doesn't go against the verses of the Holy Quran? What type of ahadith are we going to be accepting? The other thing is the context. Was this hadith said in the context where there is taqiyyah? The imam didn't actually intend for the Shia in the long run, in the future, to follow this teaching. But this was limited to the time and to the context in which the imam said it, and he wanted those Shias at that time to practice it. Whereas the actual ruling of Islam is different, and the Ma'sumin wanted us to follow that one. Sometimes that is the situation. How do we figure that out? Understanding the context, what are the words meaning in the context of the time of the Ahlul Bayt, as opposed to understanding them in today's context. understanding the wording of it, obviously, and then we need to obviously apply it, apply the ruling after having understood it. We need to apply it in today's context. But in order to understand what the Imam has actually said, we need to understand that context. That takes a lot of time. These are very simple examples that I'm giving you, which is why this whole process of ijtihad is very, very time consuming. And this is why the ulama spend so much time before they reach the state of ijtihad. And then even at that state, they don't start giving out, the pious ones at least, they don't start giving out books of fatwa. They wait until they taught that stuff over and over again. They've done a lot of research in regards to it. They've had strong students come and critique them, and they have had to provide answers for them. That has strengthened their argument. And later on in their lives, when they reached their 40s, sometimes for those who are a little smarter and brighter, for many of them in their 50s and their 60s, that's when they reach a state where people start asking them questions and they start providing the people with answers in regards to their fiqhi questions. So, back to the point, Islam encourages us, each and every one of us, to go and refer to the sources ourselves, to reflect upon the verses ourselves, to figure out what the practical laws are by referring to the words of the Ahlul Bayt ourselves. However, Islam does not prescribe that to us without telling us to do it the right way. We can't misunderstand the Ahlul Bayt. We can't misunderstand the verses of the Holy Quran. We need to understand them correctly. That takes a lot of time. Because this takes a lot of time, and a lot of people, even during the time of the Ma'sumin, didn't have the time to spend on this. They wanted to live their normal lives, which a lot of us do. They wanted to have their jobs, make a living, have a family, and, well, on the side as well, or for those who are a little more religious, not just on the side, they wanted to know what their responsibilities are, but they didn't have the time to spend to go and decipher these ahadith, figure out which one is reliable, which one is not, and so on and so forth. For these people, Islam has allowed, has given us a bit of lenience to say that you're allowed to follow the research done by another individual. And had it not been for this allowance that Islam provides for us, all of us would have to go and spend tens of years in the Hawza to reach the level of ijtihad where we can start doing our own research and figure out the practical laws ourselves. So when they say, when the scholars, when some of the mu'ammameen come and say it's wajib to have a marja, you need to follow someone, what they mean is, since you don't want to go and do your own ijtihad, then the only other solution that you have is taqlid. Now, on a side note, technically there's a third option as well. All of the risalas have that, but that's something that is really not practically possible, or at the very least feasible. And that is the idea of ihtiyat, taking precaution. I don't want to follow this marja, I don't want to follow the other marja, and I don't want to become a mujtahid. Is there a third option? Yeah, well, you got to look at the fatawa of all of these marja, which is going to be a lot more time consuming than just looking at one marja. And you need to figure out how you can combine them such that you would be sure whichever of these different views was actually the Islamic law, what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has prescribed for mankind, whichever it is, that you have fulfilled your responsibility. That is called ihtiyat. So for example, if you're traveling for your studies, if you're traveling for university, then some of the maraja say, based on their understanding of Quran and Hadith, that you're not considered a frequent traveler in the sense that you would be able to pray full and to fast in the month of Ramadan. You are considered a regular traveler, which means you can't fast in the month of Ramadan, and you're supposed to pray qasr, two rak'ahs, for all the four rak'ah prayers during the day. Now, some of the other maraja, on the other hand, believe that if you're frequently traveling, even if it's because of studies, then you still have to pray full, and you do have to fast in the month of Ramadan. Conclusion for those who want to do ihtiyat is, they need to fast the entire month of Ramadan, because that's one fatwa. And they need to dedicate a time during the year where they're not traveling, and they need to make all those days up again. I don't think that's something that people would be too comfortable trying to put into practice. So this is our explanation, our understanding. Islam has allowed us not to do our own research and to rely on the research of the experts? This is the first question, and I think it's a fairly simple question. A lot of people have that genuinely, and I hope that explanation was convincing. And if it wasn't, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to complete it by the work of others, inshallah.